defense another $22 billion, which would have renovated 22,000 elementary schools in this country in return for paid family leave for federal employees. What kind of trade-off is that? There should be paid family leave without increasing the huge waste and corruption of the military budget, which is devouring infrastructure needs in this country.
Ralph, we have to leave it there. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Ralph Nader, longtime consumer advocate, corporate critic, former presidential candidate. His latest book, written with Mark Green, Fake President, Decoding Trump's Gaslighting, Corruption, and General BS. And that does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Renee Feltz and to my brother Steve. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton. Thanks to Dennis Moynihan. And I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, unless otherwise noted. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday at 4:30 p.m.
Join KBOO by December 31st and receive free gifts and prizes from the Give Guide. Just click the donate banner on the KBOO app to keep community radio strong and vibrant in Portland and beyond.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, extremely dry conditions lead to a Chinook salmon die-off.
Salem's camping ban goes into effect today.
And in international news, a new anti-Muslim citizenship law has prompted widespread protests in India.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 16th, 2019. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. Extremely dry conditions have fueled a widespread die-off of fall Chinook salmon on Oregon's north coast. After 2 months of low rainfall, hundreds of adult fish on multiple coastal streams are now dying from an unusual outbreak of a naturally occurring parasite before they even get a chance to spawn. According to the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, extended low water conditions have led to groups of salmon waiting to swim upstream in conditions that are conducive to the cryptobiota parasite. The parasite doesn't pose a risk to humans and only affects certain species of fish. In response to reports from the public of dead pre-spawned fall Chinook salmon in the Wilson River, the agency surveyed the river and discovered over 400 fish fatalities. To protect the remaining salmon, the agency closed the Wilson River to fishing earlier this month. Then the agency surveyed the Nehalem, Trask, and Kilchis rivers and found similar numbers of dead salmon. The agency has now closed all fishing for fall Chinook on the north coast from the Nestucca to Nakanakum rivers, including bays. Steelhead fishing seasons are not currently affected. Robert Bradley, a district biologist for ODFW, said the parasite has killed more Chinook than ever, further compromising the species' reproduction. Quote, "The observed pre-spawn mortality is on top of a reduced run of fall Chinook this year. We need to protect the remaining spawners to help provide for future runs of fall Chinook on the north coast." National Weather Service hydrologist Andy Bryant says some river flows on the north coast have dropped to just 10% of normal in the past 2 months.
A camping ban in Salem goes into effect today, impacting the city's houseless population. Camping on public sidewalks and other public property is prohibited, as is leaving property unattended. The Portland City Council approved the ban last month and approved funding for new shelter options. Over $200,000 has been spent by the city in hopes of providing housing alternatives, including 140 new shelter beds. Unfortunately, these beds will not be available until the beginning of the new year. A women's shelter opened on Monday at the Seventh-day Adventist Church, providing 10 beds, and there are plans for adding 40 more. The ban was passed after a hearing in November drew a number of speakers. Initially, a city property was to be designated as a temporary sanctioned camping site, but council voted to allot funding for warming shelters instead. Concern from citizens note that until these shelters are open and functioning, the houseless population is at odds with where to go. Salem city leaders declared the camping an emergency, affecting sanitation, safety, and access, as well as damaging to the local economy. Those arguing against the ban worry that by enforcing it, a vulnerable population will be pushed even further away from resources they depend on. Salem police have stated they're prepared to enforce the decision, but until shelter beds become more readily available, they'll be acting on a reactive, not proactive, basis.
And on the heels of those developments, the Supreme Court has refused to take up a case on homelessness today. That would be one that will allow a ruling to stand that protects the rights of homeless people to sleep on the sidewalk or in a public park if no other shelter is available. The outcome is a victory for homeless activists and a setback for city officials who argued the ruling undercut their ability to regulate sidewalk encampments. The Ninth Circuit Court agreed with lawyers for the homeless that prosecuting people for sleeping on the sidewalk would violate the Eighth Amendment ban on cruel and unusual punishment, given that the city had not provided adequate shelter for them. The Ninth Circuit encompasses most of the West Coast, including Oregon. The original case comes out of Boise, Idaho, however. It's from over a decade ago when Robert Martin and several other homeless people were given fines between $25 and $75 for camping on the sidewalk. They challenged those fines as unconstitutional. Boise argued that, quote, the creation of a de facto constitutional right to live on sidewalks and in parks will cripple the ability of more than 1,600 municipalities in the Ninth Circuit to maintain the health and safety of their communities. But Judge Marsha Berzon ruled, quote, just as the state may not criminalize the state of being homeless in public places, the state may not criminalize conduct that is an unavoidable consequence of being homeless, namely sitting, lying, or sleeping on the streets.
The never-used Wapato Jail may have a future despite threats of its demolition. An Oregon Coast nonprofit announced Friday that it's looking to turn Wapato into a mixed-use facility for people experiencing homelessness. Wapato is owned by Jordan Schnitzer, who bought the property from Multnomah County, envisioning it to become a homeless shelter. In 2016, the county commissioned a study to see whether or not Wapato could work as a homeless shelter, and the report estimated a $95,000 price tag on renovations and $1.6 million each year to keep it operational. That price is estimated to be greater now. Alan Evans, founder and CEO of Helping Hands, expressed interest in renovating the space, and Schnitzer has offered to contribute $1 million to the cost, which is estimated to total $3 to $4 million. Helping Hands hopes to turn the former prison into the Bybee Lakes Hope Center, a facility that would offer support services from outside partners, an emergency shelter, and a transitional housing program. The plan's not finalized, and Helping Hands will begin accepting donations for the project immediately to meet the needed funds. Evans said, "We're asking business owners who are worried about the people sleeping in their doorways to join our team. We're asking politicians, we're asking other people to join together to see if we can make a difference together as a team."
On Friday, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler and other city leaders announced new climate policy commitments. That was with the goal of reaching net zero carbon emissions by 2050. The policies focus on reducing greenhouse gas emissions from city operations and transportation. TriMet General Manager Jug Kelsey announced that the Max Light Rail system will be converted to 100% wind power by February of 2020. Additionally, after 2025, the Transportation Agency will no longer purchase diesel fuel buses. By 2030, they intend to have at least 340 electric buses. Another new policy is one that requires carbon offsets for any city staff-related travel and would create a local carbon offset fund. A carbon offset is a reduction in emissions of harmful greenhouse gases in order to compensate for emissions made elsewhere. Mayor Wheeler also announced a climate test for the city, which puts an internal price on carbon, incentivizing city bureaus to make climate-friendly decisions and to avoid those with high carbon impact. Wheeler also thanked local youth for their efforts to implement change within the city. Youth climate advocates had given a list of demands to Wheeler on two separate occasions. First, after the September 20th climate strike, and again after the ensuing one on December 6th.
A Washington utility company has made a commitment to step away from its reliance on coal. As Eric Tegedoff reports, the utility company Avista is one of six owners in the Montana-based Colstrip power plant, the largest greenhouse gas emitter west of the Mississippi River.
An Eastern Washington utility is cutting its reliance on coal in exchange for more renewable energy sources. Avista has decided not to support any investments that extend Montana's Colstrip power plant past 2025. Colstrip is the largest emitter of greenhouse gases west of the Mississippi River. The commitment comes in a rate case settlement, in which Avista also asked to raise rates by more than 6%. Washington utilities are under pressure from a new state law requiring them to end their reliance on coal by 2025. Jason Thaxton with Avista says the company is focused on reducing its carbon footprint in cost-efficient ways.
Any decisions that we can make or actions we can take that reduce carbon dioxide or greenhouse gas emissions in a way that preserves the affordability of the service for our customers is the right thing to do.
The state still is considering Avista's rate case settlement. The Spokane-based utility serves about 350,000 customers in eastern Washington and northern Idaho. Avista has bigger climate goals as well. Earlier this year, it announced goals to be carbon neutral by 2027 and to get 100% of its electricity from clean energy by 2045. But Thaxton says the company doesn't intend to leave Colstrip behind and has proposed $3 million for the Colstrip community in its rate case settlement.
If we have an opportunity to help the community that's been partnering with us for over 30 years to diversify the economy of the community, to help employees who might be affected by changes at Colstrip Generation to transition into new jobs or new economies, then we want to be part of that.
Avista is one of six owners of the Colstrip Power Plant, including two other Washington state utilities, Puget Sound Energy and Pacific Power. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Oregon Supreme Court upheld a decision to suspend Wasco County District Attorney Eric Nisley for lying to investigators. Nisley is suspended for 60 days after it was found that he repeatedly lied to investigators about whether he retaliated against a county official who had once rejected his sexual advances. The case goes back to 2014 when Nisley asked the state to investigate two small loans made by then Wasco County Finance Director Monica Morris. Those loans were made to an intern using money from the county's petty cash fund. The loans were deemed legal, which Nisley disagreed with, and he continued to investigate on his own. This prompted the county attorney to file a complaint with the state bar, alleging that Nisley was retaliating against Morris for rejecting his sexual advances in 2011. The bar found Nisley's investigation to be retaliatory and that he had lied about it to investigators on six different occasions. Nisley told the Oregonian, quote, "I read the opinion, and I disagree with its conclusions. This does not define me about who I am or how I live my life." Nisley has been the Wasco County District Attorney since 1999 and says he has no plans to step down, that despite the 60-day suspension during which he is not allowed to practice law.
The Trump administration's Bureau of Land Management has approved fracking and drilling on 1 million acres of public land in California. Suzanne Potter has more.
More than 1 million acres of federal public land on California's Central Coast and San Joaquin Valley on Thursday, despite a flood of public comment in opposition. The Bureau of Land Management will now allow for new lease sales in 2020 on land that stretches across Fresno, Kern, Kings, Madera, San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara, Tulare, and Ventura counties. Rebecca August with the nonprofit Los Padres Forest Watch calls fracking a very toxic process.
Fracking certainly causes impacts to local water supplies, to air quality. There's a lot of associated truck traffic. There's toxic chemicals that are known to cause cancer that can be forced through water supplies.
August also complains that fracking wastewater creates a disposal issue and notes that drill sites emit methane, a potent greenhouse gas linked to climate change. The BLM's environmental impact study declared that fracking will pose no significant impacts to wildlife, water, public health, or the environment. The BLM had not approved a new oil or gas lease in California since 2013 when a judge ruled that prior leases had violated federal environmental law. August says the oil in that area poses a particular threat to air quality.
And the Central Coast is home to some of the dirtiest oil, most fossil fuel intensive, carbon intensive oil, you know, that there is. So it generally requires a good deal of refinement, and that causes a lot of emissions.
A separate office of the BLM opened up more than 725,000 additional acres to drilling around the Monterey area in October. Conservation groups are already suing over that decision and are expected to challenge these new lease sales in court as well. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The state's Lutherans have elected their first female bishop to lead the Oregon Synod. Lori Ann Larson Caesar was installed on Saturday amid a packed ceremony at Northwest Portland's Trinity Episcopal Cathedral. The Montana native will oversee more than 30,000 Lutherans in 111 statewide congregations. Trained as a chaplain at Stanford University, Larson Caesar also earned a master's at Harvard Divinity School. Prior to Saturday's elevation, she has spent more than 20 years as a pastor of Beaverton's Spirit of Grace Church, which bears the unique distinction of being a house of worship that serves both Lutherans and Roman Catholics. The Oregon Synod has a reputation for being groundbreaking, as it was the first Lutheran collective to declare itself a sanctuary synod in 2016, welcoming immigrants and refugees to its faith services. Additionally, in 2005, it was the first synod to open its arms to people of all sexual orientations and identities. Blessings were given at Saturday's event from ecumenical partners from the Episcopal Diocese and Yakima Nation, with members of the Sikh, Jewish, and Muslim faith organizations also showing their support. An offering was also raised for immigrant and refugee services at Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice. Larson Caesar addressed the assembly on Saturday with the words, quote, "We stand on good, strong shoulders of leaders in the past, and we want to walk even more together toward courageous love."
Well, it's almost Christmas, and it looks like the Grinch struck again. Federal Way police arrested a man on Friday who admitted to stealing Christmas trees from a farm outside Puyallup. Snowshoe Evergreen Christmas Tree Farm has closed for the season, but last week when they were still open, they discovered 78 Christmas trees had been cut down and stolen. On December 13th, the suspect was caught and taken into custody. The Pierce County Sheriff's Department said the crime happened sometime between the evening of Saturday, December 7th, and the morning of Monday, December 9th. Federal Way police said the man admitted to stealing the Christmas trees from the farm. He also admitted to stealing a truck, cargo trailer, and fifth-wheel trailer to commit his alleged tree-stealing spree. The suspect then allegedly tried to sell the trees in a lot just outside of Puyallup. Jerome O'Leary, whose in-laws started the farm 40 years ago, told Oregon Live, "Certainly our family makes a living doing this, and so there's a financial impact. But more than that, 78 trees means there are 78 families next year that aren't going to have the opportunity and the experience to come and cut down a tree." Most of the trees that were stolen were Fraser firs, considered to be a premium Christmas tree. O'Leary said it's on average about a 7-year growth cycle before a tree is ready to be sold. The trees stolen from the farm are valued at over $6,000.
A report by Rutgers University this year said that voter turnout for people with disabilities was up more than 8% in the 2018 midterm elections. As the Iowa caucus grows closer, two groups are working to give people with disabilities a greater voice. Mike Moen has more.
The Trump administration took the final step to allow oil and gas drilling on more than 1 million acres of federal public land on California's Central Coast and San Joaquin Valley on Thursday, despite a flood of public comment in opposition. The Bureau of Land Management will now allow for new lease sales in 2020 on land that stretches across Fresno, Kern, Kings, Madera, San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara, Tulare, and Ventura counties. Rebecca August with the nonprofit Los Padres Forest Watch calls fracking a very toxic process.
Fracking certainly causes impacts to local water supplies, to air quality. There's a lot of associated truck traffic. There's toxic chemicals that are known to cause cancer that can be forced through water supplies.
August also complains that fracking wastewater creates a disposal issue and notes that drill sites emit methane, a potent greenhouse gas linked to climate change. The BLM's environmental impact study declared that fracking will pose no significant impacts to wildlife, water, public health, or the environment. The BLM had not approved a new oil or gas lease in California since 2013, when a judge ruled that prior leases had violated federal environmental law. August says the oil in that area poses a particular threat to air quality.
And the Central Coast is home to some of the dirtiest oil, most fossil fuel intensive, carbon intensive oil you know, that there is. So it generally requires a good deal of refinement, and that causes a lot of emissions.
A separate office of the BLM opened up more than 725,000 additional acres to drilling around the Monterey area in October. Conservation groups are already suing over that decision and are expected to challenge these new lease sales in court as well. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
That was an audio on fracking, and we'll find that U.S. Disabilities voting turnout audio for you after the midheads. In the meantime, only seven candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination have made the cut for Thursday's debate, and Senator Cory Booker is leading the charge to ask the Democratic National Committee to ease up on the debate requirements. With that story and more, here's Lily Bulkey with 2020 Talks.
The Trump administration took the final step to allow oil and gas drilling on more than 1 million acres of federal public land on California's Central Coast and San Joaquin Valley on Thursday, despite a flood of public comment in opposition. The Bureau of Land Management will now allow for new lease sales in 2020 on land that stretches across Fresno, Kern, Kings, Madera, San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara, Tulare, and Ventura counties. Rebecca August with the nonprofit Los Padres Forest Watch calls fracking a very toxic process.
Fracking certainly causes impacts to local water supplies, to air quality. There's a lot of associated truck traffic. There's toxic chemicals that are known to cause cancer that can be forced through water supplies.
August also complains that fracking wastewater creates a disposal issue and notes that drill sites emit methane, a potent greenhouse gas linked to climate change. The BLM's environmental impact study declared that fracking will pose no significant impacts to wildlife, water, public health, or the environment. The BLM had not approved a new oil or gas lease in California since 2013, when a judge ruled that prior leases had violated federal environmental law. August says the oil in that area poses a particular threat to air quality.
And the Central Coast is home to some of the dirtiest oil, most fossil fuel intensive, carbon intensive oil, you know, that there is. So it generally requires a good deal of refinement, and that causes a lot of emissions.
A separate office of the BLM opened up more than 725,000 additional acres to drilling around the Monterey area in October. Conservation groups are already suing over that decision and are expected to challenge these new lease sales in court as well. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the Cable Evening News, where tonight we want to make sure you have an extensive education about fracking. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on Municipal Broadband PDX. They are a group pushing to make internet broadband a public utility in Portland. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, here, Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather forecast, partly cloudy, a low down to 34. Those clouds will continue into tomorrow, and we'll see a high of 45 with maybe a little bit of sun peak. Through. Today in history, in 2004, journalist Data Hydera was assassinated. Hydera was the editor of The Point, a major independent Gambian newspaper, and was known for fighting for the freedom of the press in Gambia. The quote of the day is from philosopher Albert Camus, who said, quote, "A free press can, of course, be good or bad, but most certainly without freedom. The press can never be anything but bad."
Protests have erupted across India against a new citizenship law which gives special treatment to Hindu and other non-Muslim migrants in India. Critics say this law is the most overt sign yet that Prime Minister Narendra Modi intends to turn India into a Hindu-centric state, putting the large Muslim minority of 200 million at a clear disadvantage. The Hindu nationalist program has prompted widespread protests, which initially broke out on college campuses and has now packed the streets of a growing number of cities. Modi's government has responded with military crackdowns, internet shutdowns, and curfews. Many see a secular government as fundamental to India's identity and its future, making Indian Muslims, progressives, and Indians of other faiths feel increasingly desperate. United Nations officials, American representatives, international advocacy groups, and religious organizations have criticized the law as blatantly discriminatory, with some calling for sanctions. The law gives a privileged path to citizenship for all non-Muslim migrants, and it's galvanized Modi's opposition, which had been plagued by infighting. Indian officials have denied any anti-Muslim bias and say it was intended to help persecuted minorities in India's neighboring countries, which are predominantly Muslim. This follows a divisive citizenship test instituted this summer in the region of Assam along the Bangladesh border. All residents had to provide documentary proof that they or their ancestors lived in India since 1971. Around 2 million people, both Hindu and Muslim, failed the test and now risk being declared stateless.
Apple, Google, and other major tech firms are being sued by Congolese families who say that their children were killed or maimed while mining for cobalt that's used to power smartphones, laptops, and electric cars. The lawsuit, filed by the human rights firm International Rights Advocates on behalf of parents and children from the Democratic Republic of Congo, names Apple, Google, Dell, Microsoft, and Tesla. Cobalt is necessary for rechargeable lithium batteries that are used in tech products sold by these companies. More than 60% of cobalt originates in the DRC, one of the poorest countries in the world. Mining cobalt there has been linked to human rights abuses, corruption, environmental destruction, and child labor. The argument of the families in the lawsuit is that these tech companies aided and abetted the mining companies that profited from the labor of children forced to work in dangerous conditions. The children were working illegally at mines owned by UK mining company Glencore. And that's according to court papers, who also say the cobalt that's mined is then sold to Umicore, a Brussels-based trader, which then sells it to the likes of Apple and Google. Court documents show that the children were driven to work by extreme poverty, where they were paid as little as $2 a day for digging for cobalt in dark underground tunnels. The central allegation is that Apple, Google, Dell, Microsoft, and Tesla were aware of these conditions and had, quote, specific knowledge that the cobalt they use is linked to forced child labor in hazardous conditions. This is the first lawsuit of its type to face the tech companies, and it contends that the companies have the power to regulate their supply chain and are choosing not to.
The family of a northern Arapaho man who was shot and killed by police continue to seek answers, saying the victim was disabled and prone to bouts of confusion. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Officials in Riverton, Wyoming, recently announced a police officer who shot and killed a northern Arapaho man will not face criminal charges. As Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr reports, some community members are still looking for answers about what happened.
Anderson Antelope was 58 years old and living on the streets. City officials say he attacked the officer with a knife and that the officer had no choice but to shoot him. The county coroner had planned a public inquest into the shooting, but suspended it due to what he called a lack of cooperation from the county attorney and the city police department. That was devastating news to Antelope's sister, Levina Antelope.
I wanted to be there. I wanted to ask questions. I wanted to know what really happened. Should have been a different way to disarm her brother if he did have a knife.
Levina Antelope says her brother was disabled and prone to bouts of confusion at the time of his death. She has doubts about whether he could have posed a real threat. But Riverton Police Chief Eric Murphy says the officer would have been seriously hurt in Antelope's attack if not for an armored vest. Murphy also revealed this week that surveillance footage at the Walmart where Antelope was shot does not show the shooting.
And I'm sorry that it doesn't. I wish it did. But it doesn't. It's not Walmart's fault. It's not our fault. It's nobody's fault. So I just wish people would get past that.
Meanwhile, Antelope's family have planned a community gathering to discuss racism, policing, and substance abuse and mental health issues in Riverton and how future incidents might be prevented. I'm Savannah Marr.
In late November, President Trump formed a task force to address missing and murdered Indigenous people. Tribal leaders in attendance at the signing praised the move, while others in Indian country have mixed reactions, including in Montana. Olivia Reingold reports.
A.J. Not Afraid, chairman of the Crow Tribe in Montana, was one of about five tribal leaders invited to witness the signing.
Yes, sir. First of all, President, we are honored that you recognize the Native Nations as well as the Crow Nation. We've been proponents of the Trump administration and all the endeavors.
The task force is composed of 8 federal officials from the FBI, Bureau of Indian Affairs, and the Departments of Interior, Justice, and Health and Human Services. Tribal Councilwoman for the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes, Charmelle Gillen, says she was pleased when she found out about Trump's plans to address missing people in Indian country.
I think from an executive order standpoint, to me, it seems like all of the bases are well covered.
Now she wants tribal consultation, which the executive order says the task force will do to establish the scope and nature of the issue. Gillen's colleague, Flathead woman Shelley Fian, is more hesitant about Operation Lady Justice.
I think unless you look at the large picture, you know, what is happening upstream to cause these things, it's just going to be a Band-Aid.
She wants the task force to look at more than just law enforcement, but substance abuse and the problem of runaways, too. But she says she's not sure what they can accomplish without tribal governments at the table. A spokesperson from the White House says that there will be extensive tribal consultation, as it is vitally important to have robust input from tribal leaders, impacted American Indian and Alaska Native families and advocates and other key partners. The spokesperson says to expect the first meeting to happen in the near future. I'm Olivia Reingold.
Members of the Native community in Minneapolis, Minnesota have returned to a site which was once a large former homeless encampment. The Star Tribune reports they're calling on the city to do more to address housing. It's been nearly a year since the area was cleared. Those at the site want long-term permanent solutions as well as more emergency shelters. City officials point to new funding in next year's budget for low-barrier housing as work continues to address housing issues. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Environmental Defense Fund is charged with holding companies accountable for the amount of greenhouse gases they emit, and that includes natural gas facilities. They've adopted an interesting new tactic, and to tell us more, here's Dr. Anthony Leisowitz with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Natural gas consists mainly of methane, a potent global warming pollutant. So to help hold companies accountable for letting methane pollution escape to the atmosphere, the Environmental Defense Fund is doing more than lobbying legislators. It's sending a satellite into orbit.
That will allow us to look at every single major oil and gas facility around the world multiple times per week.
EDF President Fred Krupp says these facilities often have malfunctioning equipment or pipes that allow methane to leak. Many of these problems can be fixed, and the repairs often pay for themselves because they help reduce the amount of gas that's wasted. The International Energy Agency reports that companies can eliminate almost half of their methane pollution.
At no net cost.
But Krupp says, by and large, companies have not taken adequate action.
You have to monitor this, and the industry so far has not been monitoring for this pollution.
So EDF has partnered with an aerospace company to build a satellite that will locate and monitor leaks. He says companies will know where the problems are, and the public can hold them responsible. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
The St. Lawrence River, which is fed by Lake Ontario, is home to a number of whale species, including the beluga whale. But belugas may be at risk. With more on the story, here's CurrentCast.
Baby beluga in the deep blue river? On this CurrentCast. It sounds like a whale of a tale, but it's not. 13 species of cetaceans can be found in the St. Lawrence River. Robert Michaud of the Group for Research and Education on Marine Mammals says some, such as sperm and blue whales, live in the ocean and swim up into the river. Others, like belugas, stay there year-round.
So the St. Lawrence is an amazing area. The biodiversity out there is amazing.
But this biodiversity may be at risk. Michaud says the river's beluga population is declining, raising concerns about new contaminants in the river. So he says long-term tracking of the whales and water quality is needed to better understand the problem and identify solutions. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
A report by Rutgers University this year said that voter turnout for people with disabilities was up more than 8% in the 2018 midterm elections. As we mentioned earlier, the Iowa caucus is growing closer, and there are two groups that are working to give people with disabilities a greater voice. Mike Moen has more on the story.
In less than 2 months, Iowans will get their say in the presidential nominating process. As the caucuses draw closer, two groups are working to make sure residents with disabilities have a voice. Voter turnout rates indicate that Iowans with disabilities are underrepresented by as much as 8% when compared to other voters. Rick Shannon of the Iowa Developmental Disabilities Council says it's critical that this isn't an issue on February 3rd.
Given the complexity of Iowa's caucuses and the unfamiliarity that many people have with those processes, that gap widens when we talk about caucuses.
The council, along with the group Iowans with Disabilities in Action, hosts a webinar tomorrow afternoon at 2 p.m. Central Time. People who attend can learn more about how the caucuses work and where they can find resources. The training is open to the public and registration is free. More details are online at idaction.org. Shannon says a comprehensive guide has also been issued as part of the outreach effort. More than 300,000 Iowa residents live with disabilities. Shannon says getting more of them to participate in the election process will give them stronger input in policy matters. He adds the council hopes voters with disabilities don't run into accessibility issues like they did in 2016.
There were caucus sites that were simply not accessible to people with disabilities, particularly those who had disabilities that limited their mobility.
Shannon says there were also issues with congestion inside some of the sites, making it hard for people who needed to sit while they waited to vote, and voters with hearing challenges had a hard time absorbing some of the information. He says leaders from both political parties appear more receptive to correcting those issues in 2020. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
The Better Business Bureau is reporting that online vacation rental fraud is becoming more widespread. As Nadia Ramlagan reports, more than 5 million consumers have lost money to online property rental scams.
Fraud is widespread in the online vacation rental market, according to a new report by the Better Business Bureau. The study found nearly 43% of consumers have encountered a bogus listing. Nancy Crawford of the Better Business Bureau of the Mid-South says the internet has opened the floodgates for scammers, so shoppers need to be savvy.
There's so much fraud in today's world. About 26 million Americans are defrauded by some type of scam every year. It's a multi-billion dollar industry, and it is big business.
The Better Business Bureau's scam tracker received more than 1,300 reports of rental fraud from 2016 to 2019. The report notes that fake rentals turn up on vacation rental sites such as Airbnb, VRBO, and HomeAway.com, despite these companies' efforts to weed out scam listings. Crawford says fraudsters most often copy a photo and description of a property, post it online with their own contact information, and then try to get a deposit from the victim.
Doing some research ahead of time and finding out what typical properties in that area usually rent for will give you some information so that you don't land on a listing that's half the price of everything else and you think, oh great, this is a great deal, and then end up going on vacation and having nowhere to stay.
According to the report, renters may find websites that are actually cloned copies of Airbnb's website. Airbnb warns travelers that scammers tend to exploit popular events, such as the Super Bowl, when hotels may be booked.
With 43% of online shoppers encountering a fake listing and more than 5 million consumers losing money to these kinds of scams.
She adds that victims of a suspected property rental scam should immediately file a report with the local police and file a complaint or report a scam to the Better Business Bureau's scam tracker. For Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
A former Oregonian has left millions to several schools throughout Washington. The estate of Eva Gordon announced this week her wish to give $10 million to 17 community colleges. According to officials from Seattle College's foundation, Gordon's bequest is among the largest donations the state's community colleges have received. Gordon grew up on an orchard outside of Eugene. Coming of age during the Great Depression, Gordon's family, among many others, were not able to afford higher education. Relocating to Seattle, she worked at an investment firm as a trading assistant. By putting away money bit by bit, she was able to buy partial shares in oil companies and other industries. Eva married stockbroker Ed Gordon in 1964, but they never had children. They resided in Seattle's East Queen Anne neighborhood. The Gordons, largely due to Eva's resourceful and feisty nature, were able to amass a small fortune. Frequent donations were made to South Seattle College as the couple both shared a commitment to higher education. Mr. Gordon died in 2008. In her later years, Eva was secretive about her growing investments and spent much of her time volunteering. Her death in 2018 at the age of 105 revealed her ample financial nest. Gordon's bequest will translate to scholarships aimed at new students and other support. About half of the state's community and technical colleges will share in the gift, with each receiving roughly $550,000.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 16th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, the producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Danielle Parks. The director of Evening News is also Althea Billings. And a podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, we'll hear Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez at 8. It's the Abe and Joe Talk radio show, which covers politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener comments. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, your weekly hour devoted to lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Then, at 11, it's Stage and Studio, which presents an encore broadcast of host Dime Roberts' conversation with Portland author Renee Denfeld about her book, The Butterfly Girl. At 11:30, it's Art Focus, where host Joseph Gallivan interviews photographer John Gottschall about his show, 16 Cranes. KBOO's an independent, non-commercial, community radio station powered by our volunteers and our members. By making a donation through GiveGuide on kboo.fm/give, you're eligible for more than $4,000 of free and discounted products from your favorite Portland brands. If you'd like to become a member, you can go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. And be sure and stay tuned for KBOO's News and Depth. We'll be talking about making the internet a public utility.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Welcome to In Depth, and our in-depth guests today are from Municipal Broadband PDX. On the phone, we have Michael Hanna, and in the studio, Russell Sr., both board members for Municipal Broadband PDX. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And do we
have
Michael on the phone? Hey, there you are, Michael. Hi.
You
know, this is such a fascinating subject. The organization's goal here is to give consumers an alternative to the current slate of privately held internet providers by creating a community-managed network that's built to serve its people. That's essentially saying you want to make the internet like a public utility, like water and power and so forth. We really appreciate you joining us here on KBOO to talk about this today. Now, I just gave a brief description of the goal of Municipal Broadband PDX and its mission. Can you tell us a little bit more about how the organization started, why you decided to take on this goal of providing a public alternative to current internet providers?
So I've been involved with an effort to try to get telecommunications policy working in the interest of the users for the last over a decade with an organization called the Personal Telco Project, which is a local nonprofit. And We've been fighting for this for a while. Back in 2007, the city of Portland actually did a feasibility study to look at this and came back with a sort of a marginally positive result, but they decided not to go forward with it at the time. And subsequent to that, we had, you know, the potential of Google Fiber coming, which kind of put a campaign on the back burner. But it really got reignited 2 years ago when the incoming Trump administration FCC chairman said, oh, we're going to get rid of the net neutrality rules. And at that point, you know, it smoked people out of the woodwork. All of a sudden, there was a groundswell interest in creating a public utility where, you know, the user's rights could be validated in some way. Right now, basically, users don't have rights, and there's no institution really willing to stand up and give them rights.
So we're going to talk a little bit more about net neutrality later on, but first I want to back up a little bit. I know that probably most people listening could answer this question in some way, but what are some of the problems with privately held internet providers when it comes to accessibility?
Well, so first you have literally your choice is to either subscribe or not subscribe. There's no institution that's either willing or able to give you any more rights than that. So the big opportunity, and on top of that, they're just extracting wealth from people who use the internet here. On top of which, as a function of that, and their ability to control price, there are many, many people in our community that just can't afford it and forego what, you know, today is an essential utility, you know, an essential part of, it's no more a luxury than paved streets.
Right, exactly.
And just to add on to that, that surveys have found that that about 28% of Black and Latinx and low-income households in Portland Metro lack broadband in the home.
Wow.
So there's a significant portion of our population that's being left behind. And as Russell said, you know, this is just a fundamental part of life now, just like electricity or water. It should not be a luxury.
Right. I mean, you need the internet to get a job. You need the internet to hook up your electricity and water in lots of cases, you know, to buy a home,
exactly.
To rent a place. It's not like it's an option anymore to do without.
To be a student, too. I mean,
to do your homework.
Everything is online now.
Right. Well, I can imagine that the privately held providers really want to protect their turf. And have they been actively involved in trying to quash this effort?
Not allowed. They've been very quiet publicly. Mm. They've been not shy about spending money in other places where this has been on the ballot. For example, approximately 2 years ago, there was a ballot initiative in Colorado where they needed to, they actually have to have in Colorado, they have to have an election just to consider doing this. They have to opt out of a state law. And they were outspent by the cable and telephone companies there $1 million to $15,000, and yet the citizens of, this is in Fort Collins, Colorado, the citizens there still voted 60-40 to go ahead. In fact, they're rolling out right now and signing up customers.
Wow. So since you talked about Colorado, let's open this up a little bit. This really isn't a very new idea. As you mentioned, it had been investigated in 2007 here in Portland.
Right.
And apparently it's a public utility in some other countries as well. Where has it been successful?
You know, I'm not so familiar with the examples in other countries. I know there are places, you know, Sweden has a much different telecommunications model than we do in the U.S. And I know, you know, East Asia, South Korea and so forth, they have a different model as well. In the U.S., we're sort of constrained by what the FCC lets us do.
Mm-hmm.
They basically set the rules on internet, and you know, they've basically been just handing the keys over to the companies that own the infrastructure.
Have they been in any way helpful? Are they interested in partnering with your efforts in any way?
Not so far
no.
that we've
heard.
Well, I'm just wondering.
Yes.
I mean, I'm just thinking from a public relations standpoint, they're always trying to make themselves look better and more community-minded. This would be a great way to do it.
Well, from an efficiency point of view, it's really silly to have more than one infrastructure in the streets. There ought to be a high-capacity infrastructure, and then everybody ought to be able to use it. It's called an open access model. They do that in different places. We used to do that for DSL here. Mm-hmm. You could, you know, the phone company owned the phone wires that went to your house, but if you were an ISP, you could essentially contract with a phone company and be able to sell your ISP services over the DSL. So the thing that really screws us here is that it's super expensive to put the infrastructure in the street. And then the rules around that are such that the owner of that infrastructure basically controls it completely. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to get a competitive environment that way. You know, from you don't have choices, basically.
I think one key thing about the puzzle, too, is that currently the two largest providers, Comcast and CenturyLink, are running over their own networks. And so they're running over, Comcast is running over the coaxial cable, you know, old cable TV wires that run into houses and businesses. And then CenturyLink is running over the twisted copper phone lines that have been there for a very long time. And so really what we're exploring in municipal broadband is running a whole new infrastructure along fiber optic cables, which, you know, most industrialized nations in the world are doing, running fiber optic to the home, because that really is the backbone of the internet, and that's really the only way to future-proof the network, you know, is something that has very high capacity, operates at near the speed of light, and would be an entirely new network. And so I think that's part of this whole thing too, is that this would be a brand new infrastructure. And with Comcast and CenturyLink, the two biggest providers, they have their own networks. And so there would be no reason for them to collaborate with us on this, because it would be a threat to their existing networks.
Gotcha. So while we're on the subject of building infrastructure, what do you guys think about this national push for 5G, and how does that affect your network?
So 5G is what I like to call a gigantic hype storm right now.
Oh, okay.
So it means different things in different contexts. You'll see ads for things that are just kind of silly and not really connected to reality. And then they'll conflate that with something else. For example, T-Mobile was talking about their low-frequency things and how it'll go miles. And then they talk about super-fast things, which actually only goes about 200 feet, or 200 meters maybe, which would require stuff all over the place and does not go very far. So there are people talking about different things, and in the end, it's the phone company owning your access to something and being the sort of privileged middleman in that interaction. So your interests are not going to be well represented with 5G.
Gotcha. So let's talk a little bit about net neutrality, which we touched on a bit earlier, which sort of dovetails into this. Define the term right away.
So net neutrality is basically the idea that the carrier can't privilege one kind of traffic over another.
Somebody pays more, they get faster service, that
right.
sort of thing.
And, right. And, you know, there are analogies for this with, like, public streets, mm-hmm. right? You can drive or bike or whatever down a public street and turn off anywhere. You can go to a public or private endpoint at the other end of your trip. And that's kind of what net neutrality is. There's an infrastructure. No one tells you where you can go and where you can shop. You can get from one place to another one, as well to one place as to another, pretty much. And so that's the basic idea. And because the carriers have this control, they can use, dollar bills go off in their eyeballs, and they say, we can make rules that favor us in some way, mm-hmm. you know, and it's a blank slate of things that little games they can play.
Well, of course, the previous administration felt strongly about net neutrality and how it was absolutely essential. How has that changed with the current administration? I mean, obviously a lot.
So the reality is that over the last couple of decades, the rules haven't changed that much. I mean, they've been continuously hostile towards the user and in favor of the owners of the infrastructure. There was a brief window in the end of the Obama administration where they finally found something that was an enforceable way of enforcing net neutrality. And we had that window where they said, hey, this is what we're going to do now. This is great. And everybody cheered. And the new administration came in and they said, no, we're going to yank that all back again. Mm-hmm. So, we get these little bones tossed to us as users occasionally, but the overriding thing is that the FCC really isn't our friend one way or the other, and we need to be solving this at a local level.
Okay. So we are talking with Michael Hanna and Russell Sr. They are board members from Municipal Broadband PDX about the goal of making internet service a public utility. So tell me, if this were to happen, what do you see as the impact on the community?
Certainly in the long term, we'll save lots of money. Right now, we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars on telecommunications just in Portland alone. I think the number I came up with was $300 million in revenue every year that goes to Comcast for their cable operations, which includes their television and their internet. We don't know exactly how much it would cost to build a network like this, but it's on the order of either $500 million or something like that. Maybe a little bit more, maybe a little less. That's partly what this, there's a feasibility study right now going on to help establish
here in Multnomah County.
On. Yes, exactly.
Okay,
right.
All right. And any status updates on that plan at all?
So it just launched in October. We're hoping to have results in the spring, you know, hope April to June sometime. And then we'll have a lot more information on which to judge.
And Michael, you're on the phone, so I wanted to give you the opportunity.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention a few other benefits. I mean, I think as Russell mentioned, there's the concept of keeping money in the local economy, which can boost the economy through the multiplier effect and have jobs stay local. You know, because if in terms of building out a new fiber optic internet utility, there'd be a lot of jobs, local jobs in building that network, and then there would be jobs in operating that network. And then also local businesses can benefit, you know, new startups, local businesses can thrive. So there's obviously an economic aspect, but I think there's also an inclusion and access aspect that we're really hoping to be a model for other places around the country as well, where, you know, like I mentioned, there's a lot of people who are left behind currently. And so we really want to make sure that that inclusion is a core part of this. So homes with students have access to broadband, you know, subsidized broadband for low-income or elderly households. And so, you know, really making sure that everyone gets a chance to participate in the economy and the technology advances going forward so that nobody is left behind.
So Municipal Broadband PDX has an event coming up. I want you to tell me a little bit about that. Tell us all about it.
Why don't you hit that, Michael?
Sure. Yeah, it's tomorrow night, December 17th. It's going to be out at Multnomah East building. I don't have the address in front of me, but if you go to our website, municipalbroadbandpdx.org/townhall, you'll see all the information, and it's also listed on Eventbrite on Facebook. So this Broadband Town Hall by Municipal Broadband PDX. It's a free event. Doors open at 5:30. We're going to have a taco and burrito bar and beverages, and then speakers will begin at 6:00. And we have Commissioner Lori Stegman from Multnomah County, East County. We have City of Gresham Commissioner Eddie Morales, and we have Multnomah County Commissioner Jessica Vega Peterson, as well as our County CIO, Chief Information Officer Bob Leak, will be speaking. So it'll be a chance for the elected officials to talk about this project and the feasibility study. We'll talk about our campaign, what we've been up to, and we'll get a chance. A whole half of the event is dedicated to getting feedback from the attendees at the event. So show up and give us your feedback, and we'll be collecting it for the feasibility study.
Such an important issue. And if people want to get involved in helping you with this cause, best way to do that?
Just go to our website and sign up for our email newsletter. So we get periodic emails about updates of what's going on with the campaign. So that's the best way to plug in, and also find us on Facebook and Twitter.
Wonderful. I tell you what, this sounds like an idea whose time has definitely been on the way, coming and way overdue at this point. Once again, you can get more information at municipalbroadbandpdx.com. The town hall is tomorrow.
.org.
Excuse me. I'm sorry about that. Yes, .org. municipalbroadbandpdx.org. The town hall is tomorrow night. Doors open at 5:30 p.m. Free burritos and tacos, people. In addition to talking about making, you know, the internet a utility, which is very important. Thank you, Michael, and thank you, Russell, for being
with
us here tonight on In Depth on KBOO.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for having us.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Up next is Labor Radio.
Thank you, baby. I just wanna take a little time out to you. Thank you, baby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for contributing to KBOO's membership drive. It was a success, and we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click. Tamation Nita, TTTT. Thank you for your love, for your cat.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Labor Radio? I am your host, Michael Cathcart. Joining me, as always,
Elliot Gilliland.
Thanks for being here, Elliot.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a big episode for us this week.
Yes, indeed. We are coming to you from the beautiful KBOO Studios in Portland, Oregon. Tonight, we are going to be diving into the newest trade deal that the U.S., Mexico, and Canada have all signed. It is called the USMCA, or the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, and it is a replacement, essentially, for the 1990s-era NAFTA trade deal, the North American Free Trade Act. It's being referred to as, you know, basically NAFTA 2.0, but there are some differences, some major differences, and, you know, as we'll go into, there are some improvements and some